There is a river in Washington State. It moves slowly through King County, past industrial yards, past the kind of trees that grow thick and dark and crowd out the light at midday, past stretches of highway lined with motels that never changed their signs, past the ordinary geography of a place that most people drove through without looking twice, the Green River. If you didn't know its history, you might find it beautiful. The way morning fog settles low across the surface. The way the evergreens lean towards the water with both banks like old men, bending down to listen for something beneath. The way the light hits the current in August and makes it look, just for a moment, like everything is fine. But some rivers carry more than water. Some rivers carry memory and grief and the weight of names that were never supposed to end the way they did. August 1982, a 17-year-old girl named Wendy Lee Caulfield found floating in the river. She was not the first. She would not be the last. Over the weeks that followed, more bodies surfaced along the same stretch of water. Young women, mostly runaways, many of them involved in street-level sex work, most of them living outside the margins of the system that was supposed to protect people, most of them already failed by poverty, by addiction, by homes that had broken apart long before this particular whore found them. The media gave the killer a name, the Green River Killer. And for nearly 20 years, that name hung over King County like a permanent weather system, like something that would always be there, a pressure in the atmosphere, a wrongness the whole region learned to carry, because they could not find him. Not because he was a genius, not because he was brilliant or theatrical or 10 steps ahead of investigators, but because he was invisible. He lived in a house on a residential street. He drove a pickup truck to a job he had held for years. He went to church on Sunday mornings and cried during sermon and talked to his coworkers about scripture in the break room. He coached his son's activities. He mowed his lawn. And then he drove down a certain stretch of highway and he took women and he killed them. And then he buried them in the dark and he went home and nobody saw him, not for 20 years. His name was Gary Lennon Ridgway. And tonight on Among Monsters, we are going into the river. We are going into the fog and the silence and the story of the most horrific convicted serial killer in American history. And we are asking the question that I think matters most. Now, just how did he do it? But who let him? What systems? What assumptions? What deeply embedded hierarchies of whose life matters and whose disappearance gets urgency and whose pain gets believed? What structure did Gary Ridgway build his entire killing operation inside? Because he did not just exploit a weakness in forensic science. He exploited a weakness in us. And until we look at that honestly, really look at it, we haven't told this story. We've just told his. Welcome to Among Monsters podcast. I'm Maya Vale. This is a true crime documentary podcast about the people who commit unthinkable acts and psychology behind them, the system that enabled them, and the victims who deserve to be remembered as full human beings and not just entries in a case file. Tonight's episode contains details of violence, sexual predation, and the kind of sustained human cruelty that takes a while to sit with. We will speak honestly about all of it. We will speak carefully about all of it. And we will not let the darkness of his story erase the humanity of the women at the center of it. This is the story of Gary Ridgway. But more than that, it is the story of who we failed. Gary Leon Ridgway was born on February 18th of 1949 in Salt Lake City, Utah. He grew up in Washington State in a modest working-class family on a residential street in the Rainier Valley area of Seattle, and later in the suburb of McMicken Heights. His neighborhood looked like thousands of other neighborhoods across the Pacific Northwest. Small houses, modest yards, the kind of place where people knew their neighbors well enough to wave, but not well enough to ask hard questions. Nothing about his early life would scream monster to you if you were watching from the outside. That, as we will discuss at length tonight, was entirely the point. His mother, Mary Ridgway, was the dominant force in that household. By all accounts, including Gary's own, she was controlling, emotionally unpredictable, and deeply inappropriately involved in her son's life in ways that persisted well into his teenage years. She managed his personal hygiene. She shamed him and then held him close. She escalated between smothering and humiliating in a way that Gary was never quite able to metabolize. He described her in interviews decades later with an effect that sat somewhere between love and a slow-burning rage. He resented her control. He needed her approval. He hated her and was attached to her in ways that were tangled up so deeply he could not separate one from the other. The contradiction, love wrapped around fury, directed at a woman, would become the blueprint for everything Gary Ridgway would do for the rest of his life. His IQ tested in the low average range. He repeated grades. He could not read fluently well into his adolescence. Teachers remembered him as slow, quiet, forgettable. The kind of kid who would sit in the middle of the classroom and somehow took up no space at all. He felt that. People who have studied Ridgway extensively note that the shame of academic failure, the daily experience of being the child who couldn't keep up, who got left behind, who watched others move through the system he couldn't navigate. All of that created an interior landscape of inadequacy and had no healthy outlet, no one to talk to, no framework for processing it. And so it went somewhere else. At the age of 16, Gary Ridgway led a six-year-old boy into the woods and stabbed him in the side. The child survived. When asked afterward why he did it, Ridgway said he wanted to know what it felt like to kill someone. That is not a cry for help from a troubled teenager. That is a rehearsal. The boy survived. There was no significant legal consequences for Gary. Life moved on. His family moved on. Gary moved on. He graduated high school barely. He joined the United States Navy in 1969 and served at the Pacific Theater during the Vietnam era, stationed in the Philippines, where he began paying for sex regularly and contracted an STI. He was treated for it and discharged. He came home. He got a job at Kenworth Truck Manufacturing Company in Renton, Washington. He met a woman and married her. They divorced. He married again. He went to church. He became, by all external accounts, an ordinary man living an ordinary life in the Pacific Northwest. But here is what we know now that no one around him understood then. The rehearsal was not finished. It had barely started. By the early 1980s, Gary Ridgway had constructed what I can only describe as a near-perfect camouflage. On one side of his life, the truck painter, the church regular, the Bible reader, the father, the neighbor, the coworker who showed up reliably and never caused problems. Every person who encouraged him in these spaces came away with the same impression. He was quiet, unassuming, a little dull, completely unthreatening. His coworkers at Kenworth didn't just tolerate him. Some genuinely liked him. He was described as a team player, a good worker, a kind man, the kind of man you trusted because he never gave you any reason not to. And then there was a Pacific Highway South. Pacific Highway South, referred to locally as the Strip, ran through SeaTac and Des Moines in King County. A stretch of road defined by motels, fast food restaurants, and late night commerce of every variety. It was one of the most well-known corridors for street-level sex work in the Pacific Northwest. Women worked that road at all hours, some for years, some for just a few nights before something changed their circumstances, one direction or another. Gary Ridgway drove that corridor regularly, beginning in the late 1970s and accelerating into the early 1980s. He was a frequent client. He knew the road. He knew the route. He knew the routine. He knew how to approach women, how to establish a baseline of familiarity, how to seem safe in an environment where safety was the most valuable currency available. He showed some of them a photograph of his young son. Whether this was a conscious tactic or simply a habit, the effect was the same. Here is a man with a child, a family man, a man with something to lose, a man who is not a threat. He would negotiate. He would suggest a secluded spot, somewhere private, somewhere away from the road, somewhere that made sense within the logic of the transaction, but was in reality somewhere no one would see what came next. And then he would strangle them. Manual strangulation every time. He strangled his victims face to face, up close, not with a weapon, not from a distance, but with his hands looking at them. Forensic psychologists who analyzed Ridgway in depth have noted the significance of this method. It was not chosen for efficiency or particularly. There are faster, more detached methods of killing. It was chosen, consciously or not, for intimacy, for control, for the particular experience of proximity in these final moments. He needed to be there for it. He needed to feel it. He would dump bodies in wooded ravines along the banks of the Green River, near SeaTac International Airport, in areas off the highway that were remote enough to buy him time before discovery. And then, and this is where the case becomes genuinely difficult to process, he returned. Not just once, repeatedly. He returned to the same dump sites to move remains, to obscure evidence, to ensure that what he had left behind could not be immediately connected to him. But investigators discovered through his own confessions that he also returned for other reasons, to revisit, to relive, to engage in acts of necrophilia. He placed rocks on and inside of some of his victims. He could not fully articulate the purpose of this, only that it felt like a marking, a private ownership, a ritual that existed entirely in the space between him and his victims that no one else was meant to understand. He described all of this, every detail of it, with the same flat, measured tone, the same vocal register he might use to describe a route he drove to work. No escalation, no audible shame, no crack in the surface. Just information being transferred from one party to another. That effective flatness is its own category of horror, and we will come back to it. But before we go further into what he did, I need to stop and do something that true crime storytelling does not do often enough. I need to tell you who his victims were. Not as a list of names attached to a body count, as human beings. Because every choice Gary Ridgway made was designed to ensure that these women would be forgotten, that their disappearance would not generate urgency, that the world would move on without asking too hard about where they went. Refusing to let that happen is not just the moral obligation of this podcast. It is, in some ways, the only real justice available. Wendy Lee Caulfield was 17 years old when she was found in the Green River. She had run away from home multiple times. She was known to law enforcement. In another kind of world, that familiarity with the system would have meant someone was watching out for her. In this world, it meant she was categorized as a problem rather than a person at risk. Deborah Lynn Bonner was 23. She was a mother. She had a son she loved. Marcia Frey Chapman was 31 years old. She had three children. She had been trying, as many people who end up working street-level sex work are trying, to navigate a path back to stability. Cynthia Jean Hines was 17. Opal Charmaine Mills was 16 years old. Terry Renee Milligan, 16. Mary Bridget Meehan was 18 and pregnant when Ridgway killed her. These are not cautionary tales. These are not the supporting cast of his story. They were people. They had a favorite song and things that they were afraid of, and people who loved them, and ambitions, however battered, that they had not given up on. They deserved every resource the system had to offer. They got almost none of it. And that is not a footnote to the Gary Ridgway story. That is the center of it. In August and September of 1982, as the body count along the Green River began to climb, the King County Sheriff's Office formed the Green River Task Force. It began modestly, a town team of detectives assigned to coordinate the investigation. Within months, it had grown. Within a few years, it would become one of the largest serial killer task forces in United States history at that time. Dozens of detectives, FBI profilers, forensic specialists, psychological consultants, thousands of tips processed, hundreds of suspects interviewed, enormous institutional resources deployed in the pursuit of a man who was, every night, going home and sleeping in his own bed, and they could not catch him. Let's be honest about why. The first reason is institutional, and it is painful to say plainly. Law enforcement in the 1980s, and this is not unique to King County, did not treat the disappearance of sex workers and runaways with the same urgency it applied to other missing person cases. This is documented. It is not speculation. Families of victims described repeatedly and over many years the experience of reporting their daughters missing and being told that runaways run away, that young women in sex work disappear by choice, that these were not the kinds of cases that warranted the full machinery of a missing persons investigation. Some reports were filed and moved to inactive status within weeks. Some families were told gently to wait and see if the missing person turned up. Gary Ridgway understood this. He said so directly in his own confessions. He said he chose women he believed no one would look for too hard. Women he believed the system had already decided were on the wrong side of whatever invisible line separates the people who get protected from the people who get processed. He did not create the blind spot. He found it, and he built his entire operation inside it. The second reason is forensics and technological. In 1982, DNA profiling, as we understand it today, did not exist. The techniques that would eventually close this case were not available to investigators working the Green River murders in real time. They were working with physical evidence, hair, fiber, trace materials. That was difficult to analyze conclusively and nearly impossible to attribute without direct match. Ridgway was careful about this in ways that seemed almost routine rather than strategic. He used condoms. He was methodical about fingerprints. He disposed of evidence. He moved bodies. He operated in the dark and the rain in a landscape that was not cooperative with evidence preservation. He was not a criminal genius engineering countermeasures. He was a man with a long-running compulsion who had, over time, developed the habits of someone who did not want to get caught. And now, we get to the part that is hardest to sit with. In 1983, just 1 year into the investigation, Gary Ridgway's name appeared on the suspect list. A sex worker identified him as a regular client. His truck matched witness descriptions. Task force detectives interviewed him. He cooperated pleasantly. He answered questions. He expressed sympathy for the victims. They let him go. In 1984, his name came up again. This time, investigators administered a polygraph examination. Gary Ridgway failed it. He failed the polygraph. And he still went home. Because polygraph results, as any attorney in the country will tell you, are not admissible evidence. Because without physical evidence that could survive a courtroom, there was no arrest that could stick. Because there were hundreds of suspects and limited resources, and the full weight of investigative pressure was distributed across a case that seemed to the public, if not to the detectives working it, to be cooling. He went home. He went to work. He painted trucks. He attended church. And somewhere in the woods of King County, more women disappeared. The task force did not give up. I want to be clear about that. Detective Dave Reinhart, who would later become King County Sheriff and then a United States Congressman, carried the case with him across decades in ways that clearly took a toll. He and other detectives maintained the investigation through years of cold leads, dead ends, and the particular kind of institutional pressure that comes when a high-profile case produces no results and the public begins to wonder why. They were not incompetent. They were not indifferent. They were working inside a system with the tools and the limitations that systems offer. And those limitations, in the early years, were significant. At one point during the investigation, a man named Ted Bundy, himself incarcerated and awaiting execution in Florida, offered to assist. He contacted the task force and said he believed he understood how the Green River Killer thought, that he could help profile him. The task force actually sent a detective to interview Bundy, and he did offer insights about organized versus disorganized killer behavior, about the psychology of returning to dump sites, about what drove men like him, or men he claimed were like him. Bundy said the killer almost certainly revisited the scenes. He was right. He said the killer probably lived or worked in the area and blended into the community seamlessly. He was right about that too. None of it was enough to close the gap between suspicion and proof. But it is one of the stranger footnotes of this case. The one of America's most infamous serial killers sat in a Florida prison and tried, in his own calculating, self-serving way, to help catch another one. There was also the question of what the public investigation looked like from the outside and the damage it caused. As the Green River murders remained unsolved through the mid-1980s, fear settled over the Seattle metropolitan area in a way that is hard to fully convey from a distance. Women who worked Pacific Highway South faced a particular and terrible calculation. The man who might pick them up tonight could be the Green River Killer. But they also could not simply stop. The economic realities of their lives did not pause because a predator was operating in the area. Some women carried photographs of their IDs with trusted friends. Some developed systems for checking in. Some carried weapons. They looked out for each other in the ways that communities do when they have decided the official systems are not looking out for them. And when the women from that community gave information to police, names, descriptions, behaviors that didn't sit right, they were often not believed, or believed but not acted upon with the urgency the information warranted. This is not unique to this case. It is a pattern that criminologists and victim advocates have documented across multiple high-profile serial killer investigations. The communities most directly affected by a predator's activity are frequently the communities whose intelligence is least trusted by the institutions investigating the crime. Gary Ridgway knew that. He did not need to be brilliant. He just needed the system to keep working the way it always had. The killing slowed after 1984, or at least the body discoveries did. Ridgway would later tell investigators that the intensifying scrutiny of the task force caused him to adjust. He changed his disposal patterns. He widened his geographic range. He drove further. He buried deeper. He was adaptive in a way that any organism adapts when its environment puts pressure on its survival. Throughout the late 1980s and well into the 1990s, remains continued to surface. Skeletal remains in wooded areas that hadn't been searched. Bones in places no one had thought to look. Each discovery reopened the wound for families who had been waiting years for answers that had not come. And Gary Ridgway went to work. He painted trucks. He came home. He married a third time, a woman named Judith, who by all accounts had no idea what lived alongside her in that house. He mowed the lawn. He went to church. By the late 1990s, forensic scientists had fundamentally transformed. The DNA techniques that existed when the Green River investigation began had matured into something that could extract usable genetic profiles from biological samples collected 20 years earlier. Clothing, hair, cellular material preserved, sometimes by accident of storage conditions, through decades of evidence documentation. In 2001, the King County Sheriff's Office Cold Case Unit undertook a systematic reanalysis of physical evidence from the original Green River case, working through a material that had sat in evidence storage since the early 1980s. They reprocessed samples using technology that simply had not existed when those samples were first collected. They found something, a genetic profile, matching four victims, one profile, one man. Gary Lennon Ridgway was arrested on November 30th, 2001. He was 52 years old. He had been married to his third wife for nearly a decade. He had a grown son. He was still employed at Kenworth, still painting trucks, still collecting a regular paycheck, still driving the same roads he had always driven. When detectives placed the DNA evidence in front of him, he did not deny it. He did not call an attorney and go silent. He confessed, calmly, methodically, with the same flat, effectiveless quality that would characterize everything he said about the murders for the next 2 years. He confirmed the four DNA matches, and then he kept going. Five murders, 10, 20, 30, 40, 49, and then he paused. He thought about it with visible effort of someone trying to remember how many miles they had driven last month, and he said that the number might be higher, that he had lost count. He had lost count. Over the months that followed his arrest, investigators engaged in one of the most extensive cooperation sessions in the history of American criminal prosecution. Ridgway met repeatedly with detectives. He led them to burial sites they had not found. He provided details about victims whose cases had gone cold. He described methods, timelines, locations, the specific circumstances of murders that had occurred nearly two decades earlier, with a clarity and a level of detail that left no doubt he was recounting things he had done. Detectives who sat across from him in those sessions have described the experience in remarkably consistent terms. Not terrifying in a way that you might expect. Not dramatic. Just profoundly, persistently strange. Because he sat there, this ordinary looking, plain spoken, softly soft featured man in his 50s. And he described the murder of 49 human beings with the emotional register of someone recounting home improvement projects, task by task, detail by detail. Occasionally clarifying a point when he thought a detective had misunderstood something, occasionally correcting himself. No escalation, no tears, no apparent awareness that what he was describing was outside the boundaries of anything that could be called human behavior. Just information. Just transferring of detail from one party to another. And for the detective sitting across from him, many of whom spent years of their careers searching for this man, that flatness was, in its own way, more disturbing than anything else about the case. Prosecutors faced a choice with no clean answer. Gary Ridgway was cooperating. He was providing information that no one else could provide. The locations of victims who had not been found. The specific circumstances of murders that had gone unsolved. Details that might give families something tangible after decades of not knowing. Seeking the death penalty meant the potential end of that cooperation. It meant the possibility that whatever else Ridgway knew would die with him or stay sealed behind the legal silence of a capital case headed towards execution. On the other side, 49 families, many of them, after years of waiting, wanted the most absolute form of legal consequence available. They wanted the needle. They wanted the full weight of the state applied to the man who had taken their daughters and sisters and mothers and left them in the woods like they were nothing. Both positions were completely human. Both were completely understandable. After extensive negotiation, prosecutors made a deal. Life in prison without the possibility of parole in exchange for full cooperation, detailed confessions, and the identification of burial sites for victims not yet found. On November 5th, 2003, Gary Ridgway stood in the King County courtroom and pleaded guilty to 48 counts of aggravated first-degree murder. A 49th conviction was added to the record later. The sentencing hearing lasted days. Family members were given the opportunity to speak directly to him. One father looked across the courtroom and told him flatly, "You are going to hell." Ridgway sat, showed nothing. Another family member described the years of not knowing, the false leads, the hope that kept resurfacing like something that wouldn't sink, the way a missing person case doesn't end. It just continues at a lower pitch, running underneath everything else in your life. He sat, showed nothing. A man named Robert Rule, whose 16-year-old daughter, Linda, had been one of Ridgway's victims, Rosen said, something that quieted the courtroom entirely. He said he forgave him. He said he would not allow Gary Ridgway to hold his family in a state of hatred for the rest of their lives. That Gary Ridgway had taken enough from them. That he would not take that too. And Gary Ridgway, who had absorbed days of devastating testimony about lives he had destroyed, who had sat through photographs after photographs, statements after statements, and registered nothing visible, wept. Not when confronted with the details of what he had done. Not when families described identifying remains. Not when the scope of his crimes was laid out in a legal record. He cried when someone offered him forgiveness he had no right to. I have thought about that moment many times since I first read the transcript. There is something in it that tells you more about Gary Ridgway than any forensic profile could. He could not be reached by grief, the grief of others, or any accessible version of his own. He could not be reached by confrontation with consequence. He could not be reached by the full institutional weight of the law bearing down on him in that room. But offer him something. Give him something. Make it about him in a positive direction. And something moved. Even at the end of everything. Even with 49 victims' families in that room, it was still, in some fundamental way, about him. He was sentenced to 48 consecutive life terms plus an additional 10 years. He will never leave the Washington State Penitentiary in Walla Walla. He will die in a cell, and there are still families waiting. Waiting for remains to be identified. Waiting for cases to close. Waiting for a notification that means something terrible is finally resolved, even if nothing about it ever can be healed. The Green River Task Force officially closed in 2004, but for many families, it has never closed at all. Let's talk about Gary Ridgway, not as a legal case or a forensic file, but as a psychological subject. Because if there is anything this story offers that goes beyond its own horror, it is the potential to understand how this particular kind of monster exists, how he is made, how he is missed, and what we might look for. Ridgway has never received a formal diagnosis of psychopathy, though multiple forensic psychologists who reviewed his case have noted that the profile is consistent with it. The core features are present: an absence of genuine empathy, sustained antisocial behavior beginning in childhood, about his own ability to operate without detection, and a fundamental inability to experience his victims as people rather than objects. He also showed what clinicians call extreme compartmentalization, the ability to separate domains of life so completely that the behavior in one domain does not bleed into another. The man who cried at sermons and the man who strangled women in the dark were not, in Ridgway's interior experience, in conflict with each other. They inhabited entirely separate containers. They did not touch. That is not a contradiction to him. It was architecture. He was not charming like Ted Bundy. He was not theatrical like John Wayne Gacy, who performed an identity for the public. He was not driven by a desire for recognition. He actively avoided attention. He did not want to be famous. He did not send letters to investigators or taunt authorities. He just wanted to continue. That is the core of his psychology, and it is, in some ways, the most disturbing thing about it. He was not acting out of rage, or at least not primarily. He was not responding to triggers in the moment. He was operating from a deep, sustained compulsion, a hunger that had been present since adolescence, and that regular, repeated killing did not, but simply reset. He killed, he returned home, the need built again, he killed again, over decades, without stopping, without anyone seeing it. His victim selection tells us something essential about his internal logic. He did not choose randomly, he chose strategically. Not in a high-functioning, elaborate plan way, but in the calculated way of someone who had identified the lowest risk targeted in his environment. Sex workers and runaways on Pacific Highway South were, in his assessment, women whose disappearance would receive the least institutional response. He had read the room, perhaps not intellectually, perhaps more by instinct, and identified where the gaps in protective systems were the widest. He said in his confessions that he targeted these women because he believed no one would look too hard for them. And for nearly two decades, he was not wrong. That fact does not belong to only Gary Ridgway. It belongs to the system that created the conditions he exploited, to the policies and the priorities and the unspoken hierarchies that determined which missing person got task force and which got file folders. He was a predator. He was responsible for what he did. And those systems were also responsible for what they allowed. Both things are true. Both things need to be said. Before we leave the psychology section, I want to address one more thing. There is a version of this story, and the version that true crime often defaults to, where Gary Ridgway becomes the center, where the focus narrows to his methods, his profile, his capture, the forensics, the plea deal, the courtroom drama, where the investigation becomes a puzzle and his arrest becomes the resolution. That framing is seductive because it has a structure, a beginning, middle, and an end, a problem that gets solved. But the women of the Green River did not live inside the narrative structure. Their stories did not resolve. Their families did not get closure because a man was arrested and convicted. Their grief did not end in 2003 in the King County courtroom. Some families buried remains that had been recovered and identified. Some families still have not had that. Some families heard the details of what happened to their daughters for the first time during the confession sessions, and those details did not provide peace. They provided a different, more specific kind of horror that they now carry inside the larger grief they had already been carrying for 20 years. Closure is a word that gets used a lot in cases like this. I want to use it carefully because what most families describe is not closure. It is not the neat ending of a painful chapter. It is, at best, a small pocket of solid ground to stand on. The knowledge of what happened, confirmation of the person responsible is contained. The ability to say, at least I know, at least the particular question has an answer. That is different from closure, and it is worth saying so. I want to spend a moment on something that gets less attention in discussions of this case. The woman who survived encounters with Gary Ridgway. There were women who escaped, women who jumped from his truck, women who fought back or got away, women who reported him to police, who gave his name, his truck description, his method of approach, and were not believed, or were believed but could not be helped without physical evidence. In many ways, they were the investigation, and the fact that their accounts did not result in an arrest is not a reflection on them. It is a reflection on the conditions that made their credibility something that could be discounted. If there is one thing I want this episode to leave you with, beyond the history, beyond the psychology, it is this. The woman who said his name before he was caught were telling the truth. They knew exactly what they had encountered, and they deserved to be believed. I want to end this tonight with names, not analysis, not psychology, not systematic critique, as necessary as it is, just names. Because Gary Ridgway worked very hard to make these women disappear. Not just physically, but from the record, from memory, from grief. He chose them partly because he believed that the world would not hold their absence. We hold it. Wendy Lee Caulfield, age 17. Deborah Lynn Bonner, age 23. Marcia Faye Chapman, age 31. Cynthia Jean Hines, age 17. Opal Mills, age 16. Terry Milligan, age 16. Mary Meehan, age 18. Deborah Estes, age 15. Linda Rule, age 16. Denise Bush, age 23. Shonda Summers, age 16. Shirley Sherrill, age 18. Sandra Gabbert, age 17. Alma Smith, age 18. Dolores Williams, age 17. Gisley Lavorne, age 17. These are some of them, not all. There are more names, more families, more cases still unresolved. The full truth of what Gary Ridgway did across those years has not been, may never be, fully documented. And in that absence is its own kind of violence. What makes a monster? I ask that question a lot on this show, and I've sat with every version of the answer. Is it the body count, the method, the years of sustained perdition, the particular brand of internal flatness that allows a man to kill dozens of human beings and go home and sleep and do it again? Yes, all of that. All of that applies to Gary Ridgway. But here is the other answer I keep returning to. A monster becomes fully possible when we decide that certain people don't warrant our full protection. When we sort human beings into categories of more valuable and less valuable, When we determine quietly, structurally, thorough policy and practice, rather than stated policy, that some disappearances are more tragic than others, that some lives warrant more urgency than others, that some people are, in a final accounting, more worth finding, Gary Ridgway did not invent that sorting system. He inherited it. He used it. He hid inside it for 20 years. And until we are honest about that, not as a historical artifact from 1982, but as a question about how our system works right now, today, in 2026 and beyond, we have not actually learned what this case had to teach us. The Green River still moves through King County. The trees still lean toward the water. The fog still settles on the surface in the mornings. And somewhere in that landscape, in the history of it, in the weight of it, there are places that remember what happened, that hold the memory the way water holds cold, long after everything else has moved on. I think they always will, and I think they should. Thank you for being here tonight. I'm Maya Vale, and I want you to know that every episode of this show is built on a single commitment. We will not exploit the stories we tell. We will not sensationalize suffering. We will not let the perpetrator's story eclipse humanity of the people he hurt. And we will keep saying the names. If you were moved by tonight's episode, please share it. Leave us a review. Tell somebody about the show. And if you have information relevant to any unsolved Green River case, the King County Sheriff's Office Cold Case Unit continues to accept tips. Until next time, I will see you in the dark.